Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to The Checkout. You know it's a podcast. Hopefully you've subscribed to it already. Hopefully you've subscribed to Jazz United, too. All of our shows are archived on our homepage at checkoutjazz.org and wbgo.org. I'm Simon Rentner. What you're listening to right now is the latest release from the multi-instrumentalist and vocalist Jen Hsu. And she sat down with our editorial director, Nate Chenin, to have a very heartwarming, personal, almost confessional kind of interview about her new recording, Zero Grasses. But before we bring you this podcast, I just want to let you know that our upcoming $300,000 Summer Guarantee Fund Drive is coming. On Friday, June 4th, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, The Checkout is presenting a concert for you with three modern masters: Mark Dresser, the contrabassist, Michael Dessen, the trombonist, and Myra Melford on piano, a telematic concert where they're going to be performing from their California homes. Mark Dresser all the way down in San Diego, Myra Melford in Berkeley, that's almost 500 miles away, performing in real time, live, using state-of-the-art technology. So mark your calendars. We hope to see you there. We'll be streaming at wbgo.org, on our YouTube channel, and also on our Facebook page. And hopefully you'll bring your wallet to the occasion too and give a little for The Checkout. Again, that's Friday, June 4th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, the personal journey of Jen Hsu. We hope you enjoy it. Thanks for checking in. A breezeless night, unmoving.
Welcome to The Checkout. I am Nate Chenin, the editorial director at WBGO. I'm sitting in this week for Simon Rentner, who is producing this episode. And I'm excited to welcome a very special guest, the vocalist, composer, band leader, multi-instrumentalist, ethnomusicologist. What else have we got? Jen Hsu. Hi, Jen.
Hi. So great to see you and hear you.
Welcome to The Checkout. Yes. I think is this your first time on the show?
It is.
Well, we're so happy to have you. And especially to talk about this new recording, which has been receiving all kinds of acclaim all over the place. New York Times, the Washington Post. Wall Street Journal. That's right.
The Post would be great.
Yeah, let's put that out in the universe. Are you listening? This is an album called Zero Grasses, Ritual for the Losses. It's absorbing and quite beautiful.
Your time is here, do not fear. Grasp your future in your hand. Spring is wonderful. Everything comes off a little brighter when it's springtime.
For anyone listening who is not familiar with this work or with your work, this really is a multidimensional and multimedia piece, and there's a wonderful presentation that you did at Roulette recently that we will feature on the show page for
Amazing.
This podcast. And what you'll see if you watch this performance is that Jen is not only performing with other musicians, but also enacting, you know, various choreographic movements, as you often do, and incorporating projected visuals, including pages from your diary.
Yeah.
And so it's a really kind of sort of performance art, theatrical presentation.
Oh, hi, I'm Jen. Nice to meet you. Oh, you don't want to shake my hand. I have a little cold. Please have a seat. I'm curious, are you Taiwanese? Yeah. So, Oh, my dad's Taiwanese.
When you mention ritual for the losses, the most direct translation there refers to your father, who passed, I think, in 2019. Is that right?
Yeah. It was a chance to talk about dad in kind of the way he was to me as a child, since it delves into my diary entries. And he really was a warrior, he coming from Taiwan, and he used to tell us stories of when he had no shoes because he was born in 1941, kind of wartime. And he really just studied his way to the States. He was the only son of seven children. He had six sisters.
Wow.
And he would tell us he would blame his bad eyesight on the fact that he had to study by candlelight, through the night. And it'd be so hot because there were, no one had air conditioning at that time in his neighborhood. So he would go to the roof and just study on the roof and with his books. He'd bring all his books up there. So he had already gotten his bachelor's, I believe, at University, Cheng Kung University in Taiwan, and got a scholarship to study at Syracuse University, since he placed near the top of his class. And that was a time when a lot of, kind of top tier academic, doing well in academics in Taiwan were allowed to come to the States and study. And then he got a job at Caterpillar in Peoria as an engineer, mechanical engineer. So dad was, he was so hardworking, and he instilled that in us since, the day I remember even being aware of being alive.
Today, I practiced violin, piano practice, stayed home, and watched Romeo and Juliet. And at 2, I did dad's math assignment. I ate lunch during TV, and mom came home, and I continued with math, and dad came home. I ate dinner. I went upstairs.
What was striking in my diaries when I read them, after after he passed, after mom gave them to me, when we were kind of rummaging around in the closet, what struck me was that I really was hungry to find him in my diaries, and because almost I just wanted to relive all these memories, and it's part of grieving. But what struck me was he was always in the background.
Today I went to the ballet studio and they shot pictures of me. I went home, watched TV, practiced, read, played outside. Dad taped me playing piano, ate dinner, and it was fun.
I mean, I had an almost idyllic childhood until a certain point when was it? The kids started making fun of me around when I was 12, 12 or 13.
Yeah, that's the perfect time to start getting.
Yeah. And, but it's funny, I had started those diaries at age 8. Like, I was 8 when I started writing in these diaries and with this big cursive, when I read, it was like, oh, dad took me to the lesson, and oh, dad took us on this amazing vacation to Glacier National Park. And there was a lot of nature. I realized how much nature was in our childhood. It was every summer. Dad wanted to take us to some, Grand Canyon and whatever, all the national parks that the Badlands in South Dakota. And that was like a huge part of my childhood. And what was striking also was, I guess I would write things that dad would say, pieces of advice.
His daddy always warns, pretty girls get cute.
When I was creating Xeograsses, I think I received the commission. John Zorn emailed me and said, hey, Jen, I've got this. I want to offer you this part of the stone commissioning series. I want to offer you a night. And then I made this plan. I applied for this fellowship, which would allow me 5 months in Japan, the U.S.-Japan Friendship Commission. So about a month and a half into my stay in Japan is when I got this really eerie email in all caps,
while I was in a Japanese lesson. I was just randomly checking my email during our lunch break and saw this weird email in all caps saying, you know, in reference to your father, Tsupin Shu, you know, I'm sorry to inform you that your father has passed away.
April 3rd, 2019, 11:37 a.m. In reference to your father, Tsupin Shu, dear Miss Shu, I'm a deputy with the Fort Bend County Sheriff's Office in Richmond, Texas. I am sorry to inform you that your father, Tsushu, has passed away. I possess as a courtesy by your mother to email you, since she did not know how to get a hold of you.
Of course, I thought it was a joke. I thought, oh, it's some spam. It's a joke, you know. And I almost, the first thing I did was I ran out into the little office of my teacher and all the other kind of administrative folks there. And in Japanese, I said, you know, Chichi wa nakunarimashita, which is like, my father died. And they almost, like, my teacher almost chuckled because it was so outrageous, you know. And then I ran back into the classroom. And it was always all alone. It happened to be a holiday or something that day. And So I just went in and I called mom. And it was nighttime for her. You know, it was like 11 for me. And it was like 9 p.m. or something for her. And I'm like, Mom, what? Is this true? And she said, yeah. She was surprised, but she just said it was in his nap, like during his nap before dinner. He just left, like he died. And we don't know why yet. At that time, we still don't really know. It probably was a heart attack.
The sage's father slipped into eternal dream. So her friend flew to her to comfort her, and found the sage sitting on the ground, danging an overturned pot with a spoon, singing with joy as loudly as she could. Her friend asked, how can you sing with joy? This man gave you life, watched you grow, but now has died in his sleep. Why do you not weep? The sage said, my dear friend, of course I mourned at first, on reflection, I understood. In the beginning, he had no life, no spirit, nobody. But then he was given life, given a spirit, given his body. Now things have changed again, and he is dead. He is joined the great cycle. Between heaven and earth, why then should I cry as though I don't know the cycle of strife? There I stopped crying, and now I celebrate his life. Joy and anger, sorrow and happiness. Caution and remorse come upon us by turns with ever-changing mood. Oh,
listen to Father Slipped Into Eternal Dream featuring Jen Hsu, Jade Tongue, her new recording Zero Grasses. We continue our conversation, WBGO's editorial director Nate Chenin with Jen Hsu.
So when I was little, my dad, he told me about Zhuangzi, who is the philosopher, Taoist, you know, he was a poet and philosopher and very clever writer. But my dad was a Confucianist, he likes to say. I mean, he was pretty open. I mean, he wasn't really a religious person. And even when we were little, you know, he had always said, you know, don't just choose when you're older. You know, we don't want to tell you what to believe. You choose when you're older. So, you know, but he talked about Confucius. He would talk about, you know, just doing the right thing and doing unto others as you would want to have done unto you. And he's very practical, extremely practical. And so I had to be the organizer of the memorial. And I performed on my lute. You know, it was the hardest performance ever I have ever done.
I can only imagine.
So of course, we had to find a quote so we could make a little bookmark to give everyone, you know, the memorial. And so I was like rummaging, you know, just searching the internet, Confucius quotes. And Zhuangzi, I thought, oh, wait, I remember he told me about Zhuangzi. You know, and I read some parables of his. But on the internet, I found this quote about, you know, joy and anger, sorrow and happiness. And the talking about the instruments, caution and remorse, come upon us by turns with ever-changing mood. They come like music from the hollows, like wood when played by the wind. Or how mushrooms grow from the damp. Daily and nightly they alternate within, but we cannot know whence they spring. Without these emotions, I should not be. Without me, they would have no instrument. And I read that and I thought, you know, I said, Mom, Henry, like, look at this, because he loved music. And so going back to the parables of Zhuangzi, so when I was reading this parable about when the sage, being Zhuangzi, lost his wife, the parable begins with he's hitting a tub with a stick and is singing at the top of his lungs, you know, and his friend, you know, visits him and he knows his wife has just died. And so he asks the sage, like, what are you doing? You should be grieving. You shouldn't be singing, you know, at the top of your lungs. And so Zhuangzi says, yes, of course I grieved at first, but then I thought about how, you know, at first my wife had no body and no spirit and no, you know, and then she was given a body and given a spirit, and now she has died. And so this is a cycle of life. If I were to grieve and cry about this cycle, it would mean that I don't understand the cycle of life. So it was such a, this parable, I've actually ended up sharing that story with friends of mine who had lost loved ones, or, you know, and they really appreciated this wisdom, because it's reminding, and that while you're grieving, you can know that, okay, this is part of the cycle of life. Mom had told me after the memorial, finally she told me what happened at that moment. And, you know, when she couldn't wake up Dad, and she was like, he was sitting in the garage in his favorite chair where he just hangs out and reads. And he was there in his usual spot, and she did peek out and he looked like he was asleep because he often napped in that chair. So then she goes back to cooking dinner, and then it's like, wow, he hasn't come in for a very long time. So she went back into the garage, and then he just was non-responsive. Mm-hmm. And she held his hand. It was warm, you know. And so she didn't – she's like, wake up. And then she got a pot and a spoon from the kitchen and was like bang, bang, you know, like clanging it away, trying to wake him up, and he wouldn't wake up.
Yeah.
And – you know, and then finally she called their other good friend who was a doctor, and then he said, call 911 right away. And it happened so fast. She said within like a minute, the ambulance was at their house. They checked for his pulse. It was already too late. And she said, and, you know, by that time his hand was cold, you know. Mm-hmm. So they didn't even take him to the hospital. They took him straight to the mortuary. But when she told me about the clanging pot, I'm like, Mom, you didn't tell me that before.
Yeah.
And while I was like, you know, reworking the piece, this is even after I had premiered it, and I was kind of reworking, I felt like something was missing from the beginning of the show, like some kind of something to enter more into the ritual space.
Because set the space,
Wake up. Hello.
For some reason, I made a connection. Like, I was thinking about the Zhuangzi poem, Joy and Anger, Sorrow and Happiness, and then remembering, like, wait, my mom, like, she was banging a pot with a spoon. And that clicked for me. It kind of evoked that parable.
Right.
That I had known, like, for, you know, 15 or 20 years. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And so that's when I kind of adapted it to be the sage being the daughter who lost her father.
There is something about this, about Zero Grasses, that is confessional. Uh-huh. Because you are literally pulling excerpts from your diary.
Yeah. And
going back to some of the most vulnerable periods in your childhood.
Yeah.
And so Let's talk about what that means, and was that a difficult decision for you to go there? And especially, I'm especially interested in this aspect that I don't think you've addressed so much in your work previously, which is being a young Asian American kid in Peoria, and having that experience of being called a chink, and just feeling so othered.
I've just felt like more and more I've wanted to tell my story as just who I am, and also really thinking about others who might look like me or feel perhaps othered or marginalized. There are those who feel like somehow they don't belong, and it's difficult to accept. And then at the same time, just do your work, you know, express yourself. And so it's definitely something I've been thinking a lot about and taking action with knowing this and knowing what the power structures are and in our society and throughout the world. Going back to your question, I got like really broad for a second, but and mom just pulls out the diaries from a drawer in the closet and said, here, you might want these. And so I didn't look at them. I didn't even think about them for Zero Grasses or related to Zero Grasses at all at that time. What was there, seeing like how much I wrote about race when I hit 12, 13, I was like, that's kind of, I wrote a lot about how the kids treated me, how they perceived me, how I felt, like just kind of the gaze.
If I were a color, I'd be white, like a blank space full of life. If I were an animal, I'd be a swan, with my neck high and beauty like the sky. My favorite place is a calm meadow with long grasses tickling my feet. My favorite snack is peanut butter and chocolate ice cream at Baskin Robbins. I get really upset when I work hard on something, then something goes wrong to ruin it. I love to close my eyes and dream as long as I want to.
You know, I began to understand what the male gaze was, what the white male gaze was. Like, I wrote a lot about kind of that need for approval, because I saw that I was rewarded if I acted a certain way, you know, or if I projected myself in a certain way. So, you know, being sweet and kind and pretty, you know, it's like all the things that women were just raised to kind of finesse and, you know, for better, for worse. And one of the lines in one of those songs, pretty girls get kissed, is something my dad used to warn me about. Like, you know, in a way he was saying, well, this is the way the world is. Pretty girls get kissed. So of course good things are going to happen for you because blah, blah, blah. You know, you're very nice and sweet. And, but you know, that was, it was like a warning, because, as I grew older and kind of was in touch with, you know, got in touch with my sexuality and also tied to my ambitions, you know, going to New York and then meeting many older men who were in the field, and, you know, it becomes very complex. And then you quickly, you know, I kind of quickly learned, you really realize, this is where the power lies. And, you know, and just what we have to do to navigate through that space.
Well, you know, that word intersectional is a fairly recent coinage, but, you know, you were expressing an intersectional awareness as a, you know, as a, you know, preteen or as a young, a young teenager, you know, because of the ways in which your gender and your ethnicity were made so glaringly clear to you. Even your aspirations were sort of tinged by this, right? Because you thought about, well, what do I want to do? And one of your dreams is to be on Broadway in a production of Miss Saigon.
Exactly. Right?
May 10th, 1993.
Hey, diary. It's been too long. I'm 15 now. He was, I found out, 45. He played our lead of Juan Perón in the musical Evita, where I was a chorus girl and the tango dancer. He had already said I'd be Miss Saigon someday on Broadway. I love him. He'll always be my Christopher Scott, and I his Miss Saigon. 'Cause isn't that the best role an actress can get if she's Oriental? At least it is here in Peoria.
I mean, it's you, we can sort of chuckle about it now, but I mean, that was a very like sincere aspiration for you at the time,
yeah.
Right?
I auditioned, Nate.
You did?
When I was at Stanford, overseas in at Oxford, because it was the exchange program. I haven't really talked about this that much publicly, but I did audition for Kim in Miss Saigon for the London production. Like I just got myself an audition but in the application it said I was still a student, you know, and they said, oh, it seems like you're still a student at Stanford University. I said, yes, I do intend to finish that. And they're like, okay. And then I didn't get called back, but who knows, maybe I didn't sing that well either, but no, that was a very real and in the diary, because that's what I like. What I saw then is like, oh, that's the ultimate star. That's like the highest that I can achieve, probably as an Asian American
right.
actress.
And there's really only that spot.
Yeah,
available
to be Kim, it's like okay, and then realizing it's like my biggest ambition was to be a prostitute on Broadway, So what I learned, and actually what I kind of discovered in creating Zero Grasses, was that somehow I've been creating my own shows. So then my director, who's Alex Mihail, who's a great Romanian director, you know, he's like, Jen, you've made your own Miss Saigon. You know, it's like you've created your own Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize. I kind of realized, wow, it's amazing how far I've come, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Because really at that time, the only options I saw were opera singer or Broadway star. Okay, if I want to really be on Broadway, okay, Miss Saigon's the only role. Or, okay, as a jazz singer, oh, maybe I can be like an Asian Sarah Vaughan, who was my favorite singer at the time. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily I had great mentors to kind of shake me out of that very kind of narrow view of what my potential could be. It allowed me to kind of, create the hard work of creating a path.
October 11th, 1993, I'm 15. Dear Diary 2, 10:46 p.m. I've had a most interesting weekend. Friday, an eighth grader called me a chink. As I was walking off the bus, after I sold him a candy bar, I was quite pissed off. I felt degraded and confused. Why is there racism? Why did he call me by my race? This world is so confusing. I took a good long look at myself. Thank you. world is so confusing, and saw through my face. I took a good long look at myself and into my heart and soul, and saw through my face. It was beautiful, and into my heart and soul, and nothing to be ashamed of. It was beautiful. Anyway, enough of that, and nothing to be ashamed of. When I'm famous, I'm gonna set things straight. Anyway, enough of that. I've had a most interesting weekend. When I have power, I'm gonna set things straight.
So there's a line in the piece, and you're very much in that adolescent mindset, and, and you say, as a refrain, really, when I have power, I'm going to set things straight. And I think there's another variation where you say, when I'm famous, I'm going to set things straight.
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in this, and that's, I mean, what a relatable sort of adolescent feeling, you know, when because you are without power in that moment.
And
you are looking to this sort of unformed future, but I'm so curious about how that line resonates with you from this current place, you know,
like,
do you feel in some way that you are in the process of setting things straight, quote unquote?
Yeah, you are really sharp, Nate, because that's the one line. So verbatim in that diary, like those lyrics, you know, October 11th, 1993, I'm 15. And then Dear Diary 2, because I had two diaries. It was like I was on my second diary. I called it like Dear Diary 2. If that's verbatim, the lyrics are really verbatim, except for that line. It was, you know, when I'm famous, I'm going to set things straight about racism. That was the original line.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how the sort of youthful mind, you know, gloms onto fame as the as the equivalent of power, you know, and we've, of course, we all know now that fame can actually be a sort of, you know, purveyor of a different kind of powerlessness, you know.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's, I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
When I look at those lyrics, you know, as I was walking off the bus after I sold them a candy bar, I was quite pissed off. I felt degraded and confused. And this, the innocence of, you know, why is there racism? Why did he call me by my race? This world is so confusing. I took a good long look at myself. I want to give a shout out to Faye Victor, who's a close friend. And I kind of shared this song and the video I had made at one of her sessions on her Patreon page. And she said, you know, Jen, it's interesting that even at that age, you had the wherewithal to like not believe what he said and like to that you actually still believed in yourself. Even though it was confusing, you know, like the lyrics, you know, I took a good long look at myself and saw through my face and into my heart and soul, you know, and it was beautiful and nothing to be ashamed of.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, I can't believe I wrote that.
I mean, in some part, that is a gift from your parents, that sense of, you know, a firm foothold in your cultural identity, in yourself, right? Even when your environment is not supporting that.
And I do remember, you know, after that incident, I remember like, I was crying and I had, you know, was like, I got home and I was telling mom like, you know, I don't understand this and that. And the way she comforted me was, well, Jen, you know, don't worry, because they're, those kids aren't going to go anywhere. You're going to go far, but they're not going to go anywhere. You know? So if we think about race, like if I think about, you know, the Breonna Taylor lament that I had written for her and her mother. And when I was reading all these interviews, and at the time I was doing fertility treatment. So I wasn't able to go out, mm-hmm. you know, for the protests. And so I was really just reading everything just on my laptop and trying to do what I could, you know, from online. And just knowing how long, you know, this has been ongoing. Oh, and now people are paying attention, you know.
Right.
And just, I came upon this interview that was, you know, that Tamika, the mother of Breonna Taylor, had given about her concern for her health, just as an EMT, like, mm-hmm. you know, you're in the ER, you have to be careful. And so her biggest fear was that she would get COVID. How could she have known that she would be murdered and shot to death in mm-hmm. her home? So that really struck me. And she wanted to buy a house and start a family,
right,
you know, just
right.
like, oh, the very like basic things that we want, you know, in this world.
Technician, I
that piece is truly haunting and, you know, in some ways a difficult listen because the emotion is so, I mean, you know, it's so present and you inhabit her voice in the song. And it, you know, it does bring something up that I wanted to ask, which is, you know, about how your creative process and your history as an artist has been entwined with Black American music and with, especially with, you know, a kind of radical community, you know, that, that has always expressed social political protest and, you know, and been very out front on this whole struggle. You have so many creative partnerships, you know, with African-American artists who are just engaged with this subject matter as a matter of course, you know. I wanted to ask about that relationship, you know, because there are various historical tensions between the Asian American community and the Black community. And you've basically, as long as you've been an improvising musician, you've operated in that space.
The tension has been there. The solidarity, though, has also been there in a very real way. When I was in the Bay Area is when I really learned about this, the collaborations that were going on already. It really, I was really kind of blind to anything related to my racial identity and awareness, racial awareness in general, because of my, you know, just my upbringing and just trying to assimilate. Like that's what was I was focused on. But what was interesting was that of the few, since there were so few of us kids of color, you know, it was like we were all friends. Like there were the two Black students, you know, in my grade school, and then junior high came. Oh, there's two more. Okay, there's four of us, and then there was me, and then the Korean girl, and you know, so there's such a handful of us, and we got along great. Because it was like, okay, it's just us guys. then after Stanford and moving to San Francisco and meeting the Asian improv arts community and really starting to collaborate in a real way. And for the first time for me in the realm of creative music and Black American music and jazz, now I can figure out what I want to contribute, you know, to this music. And I did meet Steve Coleman at that time. I met Vijay Iyer. I met Mia Masaoka. And I met, you know, later when I moved to New York, I got to meet Henry Threadgill and Muhal Richard Abrams and learn about the AACM and get to just talk with these musicians and be mentored by them. And I owe so much of who I am today from their mentorship. You know, something that I'll never forget was my first time with Muhal, I think 2017 at the Ojai Festival. And that was it was directed by Vijay on that year. I don't know if you were there.
I was there. Yes. Oh my God. I saw you did Seven Rights.
Yes.
I was there.
You were in the audience?
I was in the audience. Yes.
What?
It's unforgettable morning.
Why
it's like
didn't
a
you tell
beautiful,
me?
Beautiful morning at that high school.
At 9 a.m.
Yeah.
Why didn't you say hi? Oh, I had no idea you were there. Okay, wow. But then the next morning, I had to fly out. So that morning, I woke up early. And Roscoe and I, Roscoe has always been a mentor for many years, many, many years. And so we thought, let's have breakfast because he gets up early. And he said, oh, I think Muhal's going to show up because he gets up early. So he did indeed show up. And like we all had breakfast, the three of us. And Muhal, you know, it was fascinating to see Muhal kind of give Roscoe some advice and whatever their conversation was. And that was, and I just felt, I don't know, I felt like I had to say, like, you know, Muhal, I just want to thank you for all your mentorship and, you know, just all these years that you've inspired all of us. And he's like, no, 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 Jen, what? You know, I really don't like that word mentorship. It's like, because that implies someone is higher than the other or better than the other. And you know, I prefer the word exchange, you know, I prefer exchange. And you know, like, I want to know more about those Taiwanese folk songs that you're talking about. And then and I was like, oh, I don't know if I even, I was like, blah, 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 you know. But that was so humbling and scary at the same time, because I've always kind of feared Muhal in a way, because he's like, I admire him so much. And but yeah, that was just huge. And I can now kind of years after that, that really had an effect on kind of how Sara and I co-launched Mutual Mentorship for Musicians. So, but that kind of those conversations, and the, like all the conversations I had with Henry Threadgill, and just his actually coming to my performances and asking me to sign a CD, or, you know, like, what, you know, I just was so, that's so incredible. I don't know how to even verbalize it, but they're kind of constant pushing of not just me, but kind of anyone in this world, you know, to push us to be our authentic selves. I can never pay that back properly. Their greatest wish was to just get to the heart of my work.
I'm so happy just talking about it. Thank you for being on the Checkout. Thank you for joining me here and being so open. I can't wait for you know, an in-person performance of this work in some in some way. You know, it seems like maybe we're inching closer to that possibility. Right. But in the meantime, I'm really happy that Roulette has posted this video, because it's a great document of everything you've put together here. So once again, I urge everyone to watch the video at wbgo.org, or Roulette has posted it to Vimeo. And lest I forget, please buy Jen's album at the Pi Recordings Bandcamp page, or at Jen's own Bandcamp page. Once again, the album is called Zero Grasses, Ritual for the Losses. It is quite a powerful work. If you've made it this far listening to this podcast and you're not intrigued, I don't know what's wrong with you.
You're not human.
Yeah, exactly. But Jen, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nate. This is a joy.
Good. come on, knock us out. A keynote key. Kusaba no tsuwa. Tama. Shirade kusa makura yume wa izu ko tadoru ran
What you heard right there, Display of the Moon, Jen Shu performing a Taiwanese moon lute and Japanese biwa, along with piano and percussion, and of course vocals throughout her entire album, Zero Grasses on Pi. Jade Tongue is comprised of Ambrose Akamusari on trumpet, Matt Maneri, viola, Thomas Morgan, bass, Dan Weiss, drums. And we hope you enjoyed this show, so much so that maybe you would consider giving us a review wherever you subscribe to the podcast. And while you're there, give Jazz United a 5-star review as well. That podcast is hosted by Nate Chenin and Greg Bryant, where you can hear him regularly. And again, we hope to see you June 4th for our live stream concert featuring Mark Dresser, Myra Melford, and Michael Dessen. 6 p.m. Eastern Time at WBGO.org. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rettner. Thanks for checking us out.